I have a two-part question. Do you think he reacts to the reacting? In other words, he goes into oscillation, as it were, and maybe a deviant cannot take the oscillation and blows up.
We have to go over the top. Have to go over the top of the hour, so we'll take a little break with some wonderful music. Okay, now back to what we were listening to. A little bit of repeat.
Question, please.
I'm unfortunately an electrical engineer whose electrons have been bandied around tonight.
Repeat that last statement?
I say, whose electrons have been bandied around this evening so much. I strike back. I'm intrigued with the dynamics of this sort of conservation of the norm. Something happens, man reacts. Now, naturally, he will react to his reacting. So in the sense of, I have a two-part question. Do you think he reacts to the reacting? In other words, he goes into oscillation, as it were, and maybe a deviant cannot take the oscillation and blows up. And the other thing, what goes on between the time he receives the stimulation and he's going back? Isn't this when he's really thinking?
This strange habit of, the old formula about we learn by going from the familiar to the unfamiliar would seem to have an oscillatory effect equal and opposite, that we tackle the new by going back to the old. And translating as much as possible all new experience into something we already know. This is the mark of the conservative mind at all times, is to pretend that whatever is new around us is really the same old stuff, slightly dulled out. And by this token, it becomes harmless. We can live with it. But yes, I would say that the response to our own responses is like participating in our own audience participation. It creates all sorts of new kinds of experience for us. And this I would just simply have to say yes to, because it's enormously complicated when you think of the environment we live in and the amount of oscillation that is going on.
Really thinking.
The mind may have to dramatize its movements that way in order to be in action, yes. Thinking is a form of action. Consciousness is a form of action. So thinking must have something in common with action. I should think of thinking itself as one of the most powerful acts man is capable of, yes. But I'm sure that this is also related to your little particles. Because the thinking is done by a bouncing around of multitudes of those.
Let's suspend this because we're running close to our closing time, and I'd like to get one more question from the outside audience and then some final commentary from our panel. Dr. McLuhan, would you advocate a great and accelerated program of investigation either to validate or disprove the theories which you present? If yes, do you believe that man could do very much about controlling, for his advantage, the transition you forecast?
Well, it's a rather large order, isn't it? But the answer is, again, as far as I'm concerned, emphatically yes. For example, in our schools, we teach only one medium. We educate awareness in the printed form, and we live with many forms in which no literacy is thought important, no training of perception thought to merit any effort on our part. I think this is pretty well indicated. I'm not suggesting we should use these forms in school. I'm not a person in favor of TV in the classroom. TV is doing far more outside the classroom than it could ever do inside. But I'm interested in training perception on all these forms and understanding of all these forms in class time, in prime time. And I'm sure that has begun to happen anyway, but I'm sure that it's mandatory that our educational establishment must simply take cognizance of the fact that we have now multitudes of environments created by things besides the printed word. I'd like to hear Mr. Jovanovich's observation, since he's very much involved in this world of providing the traditional print environment for us all.
Mr. Jovanovich, will you give us your reaction to that?
Well, I think we're all aware that there's a great deal of interest in the effect of electronics on education, and whether, in fact, machines and I'm not speaking about teaching machines a la Skinner. I'm talking about computer input-output systems, televised systems, printout systems, will in fact change the content of the grammar, secondary school, and college school, college teaching. There's no question in my mind but what it will. Now, it isn't, it seems to me to get back to my original statement about humanism. I don't think you should fear this. I don't think anyone should fear this. Technology succeeds fundamentally, I think, when it does fulfill some human need and satisfy some human value. And in education, I don't expect books to disappear. I don't expect print technology to disappear. I expect other media to come into play, and there'll be an orchestration, as to use Marshall McLuhan's word, of these media. And I don't think old values disappear necessarily under new direction. And in the world of education, the question is not whether or not engineers will succeed authors as the instructors of mankind, because I don't think this is a value that will apply to this situation.
Thank you. Dr. Himes, would you have some final commentary you'd make?
Oh, I didn't know we were at that point. Nothing particular.
All right, Bill?
I would just like to say a couple of words about the totality of television. I'm not one who believes that television in total is a big success, as you know. I have gone on record very recently and been quoted, as a matter of fact, in a magazine which must be revered locally, certainly, TV Guide, to the effect that television is marching steadily toward total stagnation. I really believe that. I've been asked if I think Batman has started a trend, and I've said I hope not. I think rather it has, I hope, stopped a trend towards stagnation. If it has demonstrated only one thing, and that is that you can do something different and a little differently and make it succeed, then it has been a success, because it may inspire others in other areas, I hope, to try to do something different in television. Television suffers from being primarily a merchandising medium, not primarily an entertainment medium, unlike the theater, unlike motion pictures. And as long as it is that, and it will always be that, as long as there is a three-network complex, or four networks even, as long as it is that, circulation and accumulation of the mass audience is what is going to dictate. Therefore, programs are going to be selected that will do that and that will help sell merchandise. I listened to the head of a large advertising agency make a speech the other day in which he said, "We select our programs to enhance the commercials." Now, that, I think, is an appalling admission. And yet, that is the nature of the business, and I don't defend it totally. I don't even defend part of it.
Well, I'd like to thank the viewers outside for sending in the questions and the audience here for contributing to our involvement, our panel guests, and especially our distinguished speaker tonight, who has given us something happening. Thank you all very much.
Out of it. Oh, I see. It's up there. It used to be here.
Right.
New technique.
Okay, that was pretty awesome. McLuhan generated a lot of heat. I will unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
Everybody's cool. What do you make of all this?
Yes, there's a lot of ideas there, a lot.
There was a lot in that.
Ping pong.
What? What about people?
Like ping pong with all the ideas he's presented.
What about the people?
It's like playing ping pong.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, McLuhan stirred them up.
Yeah. I enjoyed the Batman Dracula, the joke.
Yeah.
And there's also a few ideas that you mentioned on the translation videos. in there in the...
I mentioned something on there?
Yeah, some of the things you mentioned on the translation videos, he mentioned this idea.
Right. Hey, you were real clear when you came on. Now you get a slight echo. Are you away from your whatever the phone setup was when you first came on?
Yes.
Yeah, go back to the original way.
Okay.
You're a lot clearer that way. Yeah, that's good. I want to remember he was talking about people, the young people put on.
They
start putting on environments. Well, that's Roxy in 2012. She's putting on the rock environment, the concert environment, the festival. I'm putting on Roxanna when I do my dance. So you got two put on artists there, and you got footage of us putting on the electric media, and meanwhile we're privately putting on the old literate media by doing research and reading. So we had two put-on factors going on. You know, like McLuhan would get on TV and they'd show a show of him in 1967 or something, and he might see it, probably see it, and then he goes back to studying. But now we have that experience. There are people looking at Roxy and I in our videos while we're here doing this or doing other things. I mean, that was only for TV stars. Now, anybody can have that experience, that split experience of being in two media at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. The marvel of the instant replay. So, are we hungry? Do we want to talk about it a bit or just go right into the next McLuhan?
As you like.
You guys, do you get tired? Do you get tired listening to it? Get worn out?
No.
That was a good debate. That showed you the average mind, you know, reacting to a prophet.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was fast. He was on his feet. Bucky Fuller once said, I've seen Marshall, you know, audiences really go at him because they used to be at similar conferences. And he says, Marshall's very good. They can't catch Marshall. They try, but they can't catch him. And he's very fast.
No,
of course, you can debate.
He goes so fast, for example, when he's talking about the pictorial space, the vectorial plane affecting the changes and how we say a history, the storyline of.
Yeah.
I mean, this is totally new for me, like perspective
and you.
Affecting the way we do the storyline.
Right, and you were trained in art. You were trained in art, and they didn't teach you that.
No. No, but he mentions this, and then another idea, and then another idea, and they're all very complex. That's just like an example.
Yes, it's like Ion. He's much like Ion. He's preparing the world for Ion. He's talking way, way too fast. People never heard anything. They end up laughing at the wrong points. You know, he generates confusion. He's just going too fast on ideas they don't even know what he was referring to.
Yes, and that reminds me of his of the article you sent me. I think Bacon said, "I don't lay brick. I am an architect with the words."
Yes. Yeah.
And
he's a word. McLuhan's a word engineer. Engineering with words. Building structures and then blowing them away.
Yes, he's really constructing landscapes.
Yeah, and bubbles. You know, blowing bubbles. He creates a pattern. It glows up, and then he collapses by going and making another bubble.
Yes, and actually they're talking about Batman, like a comic. And from that, he goes into so many directions.
And people aren't ready for it. They haven't even begun to see why he would make the parallels. Like, yeah, he'll talk about cartoons and say this is a retrieval of medieval era, you know, and go back to name some medieval stuff. Another point is that people thought he was a professor, and he came in as an expert on communications and largely in academic and business formats. Meanwhile, Allen Ginsberg is down there doing poetry in cafes. Dylan is doing making records. all these other poets, Charles Bukowski, they all run around as poets. It is obviously now that he was the greatest poet of his time. He was doing poetry there. He really was doing poetry. He was enhancing perception way beyond any topicality that Ginsberg got into, promoting drugs and different things into causes. McLuhan, they didn't even know what he was fucking talking about to categorize him, which allowed him to speak to a lot more different audiences than Ginsberg got to. It's incredible. That is the real poet of that day. That's the Shakespeare. That's the William Wordsworth, you know, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the Varro, the Dante. That's what you're hearing. Because it's all a put-on. He knows he's in the wrong environment for what he's talking about.
He's like Homero? Like
Homer.
Homer.
Yes.
Yeah, he's talking about the myth of the now, of his now.
Yeah.
The amazing travels that we're going.
He's talking about the beauty. The what?
The Odyssey we are going.
Yes,
like
he's doing the Odyssey.
Talking about the trains. Like, there is a discovery or a new technology, and we're not aware of all the effects it's going to have. Like, he says, for example, in family life.
The railroad.
All the effects in our dreams, he said also. I thought that very poetic.
I knew you'd like that one when he said it affects our dream life. So he, if you think of a poet, looks at beauty and looks around and looks at nature and sees the beauty, takes the time to have repose and tranquility and to communicate the beauty that many average people are too busy to notice. He was describing the beauty of our time, the multimedia environments, the information wealth that was all around us. He was talking about the data of the present, which was the new nature.
Yes, and she also said artists are 50 years ahead.
Yes, 50 years ahead.
That was awesome.
And they all laughed. It's a rat made TV, you know, in 1980. You know, like they didn't know whether they were hearing comedy or sociology. And then in the panel, what's good is that the panelists are coming at them from different levels. The practical businessman who makes the show, he doesn't know what McLuhan's talking about. He doesn't make any sense at all. The sociologist can't figure it out. And the book guy is trying to figure it out.
Specialist minds.
Yes, yes. Now, he's playing a game there. I've seen him do it many times on this level. They ask him to spell out some details. He said, well, it'd take a week. He doesn't have to give any facts. He says, it won't take too long. This is a rapid panel. You know, I'm not going to do... Why am I getting this echo? What's causing that? Somebody's...
Well, maybe it's me.
Yeah, if you're on the speakerphone, that might cause it. Like, I'm not, no echo now. Anyways... Yeah, you have to notice he is being he often talks about the artist, the detective, the criminal, the martyr. They're all antisocial. They're not well adjusted. So McLuhan is being partly criminal there. He's not playing fair. And this is probably what pissed off the academics. I mean, we hear it. But we can hear it, and we know he does it again because we've got recordings. But people didn't know that he had said that 2 days before at another conference. Oh, that would take weeks. I can't go into that. I can't give you the facts. I can't back up what I'm saying. It takes so fucking long. Which he knows what he's doing, and he knows that'll be seen as funny later when people hear the recordings, when they figure out what he's doing. So he's actually doing comedy for future perception with the new technology. You get the instant replay. I mean, you start really looking at it, it's a genius composing going on. You know what I mean? Multi-level. Talk about creating effects. That's what he's doing. And at the same time, it is practical information for what is actually fucking up the society. You know, he actually is right.
Yeah. Bob, I read last week in the version of McLuhan, I don't know it verbatim, but... Don Field described what you were talking about, his poetry, about how McLuhan used poetry, very special, how he used it as a tool.
Yes, what I was saying is that people like Wyndham Lewis, a painter, Pound, a crazy poet. Joyce, a crazy novelist. Eliot, a poet. McLuhan said that these guys wrote essays and books and thought about what they were doing. They actually were the first to talk about the communication field because they actually were communicators, so they had to know it, and they had to look at the effect of new media on their communication habits. So the artist was not seen as a philosopher or a theorist back then. People didn't know they were writing for these obscure magazines, right, obscure journals. So is that what you mean, that McLuhan picked up? To say that he got all this, what appeared to be sociological and political knowledge from poets, that was absurd right there.
Yeah.
And that's what he always said. He got it from these...
That has to do with this grammar of the objects and the visuals.
Yeah.
Well,
that was his title often. Roxy, he often said this essay is about the new grammars for the new media. We have grammars for literacy, maybe grammars for speech, but we don't have grammars for movie or grammars for television. And people say, what are you talking about? That's just entertainment. That's just bullshit. That's just nonsense. I don't even want my kids to watch it. And he's there taking it seriously as a new language and working out the grammars, which turned out to be the tetrad.
Yes, because that's what you mean with this poetry, is the exegesis of...
Exegesis,
of...
yeah.
Exegesis of what's going on.
That's right. Of the book of scripture and the book of nature in Christian culture. Two books. Science started looking at the book of nature with Francis Bacon and those early guys around the time of print. They split nature off from scripture. But before that, in the manuscript culture, it was all religion. Only a few people read, and they studied the mind control of that society, which would be the religious belief system. And you know, the Evergreen said,
let me just say,
I want to just say this fact. The Evergreen said, I talked to St. Thomas Aquinas one point, and he regularly smoked marijuana, or whatever he could get. Everybody did back then in the Middle Ages. You know why? Because they had to expand their mind to find a new interpretation of Scripture. That's all they would write about. They had to find new meanings. And so they'd get themselves in an altered state, and they reread something they read 1,000 times. Oh, I see that thing. So they actually were trying to figure out new levels of meaning in Scripture, and they would use psychedelics to help them. Now, that's an amazing historical fact that I imagine the church would deny, but he told me. I talked to him.
Yes, that's one of the things I just discovered with this article you sent me about McLuhan's PhD.
Patristic inheritance is what it's called.
Yeah, that in most of these thinkers were all grammarians.
Yes.
And that's why I said that you are the hermeneus, the translator, the one that is finally completing all these work of encrypting the book.
That's right. And here's a personal thing. There was in the local high school where I write about my diaries, and I'd go around and see the young guys in the high school. Well, there was this old spinster named Mrs. Devan, D-E-V-A-N. No, Miss Devan. Very plain and basically ugly. And all the kids, they were just disgusted with her. But she taught grammar. Well, many years later, I had a dream where she fucking raped me, or fucked me, this old hag. It was a startling dream, you know, what the fuck? I mean, if I'm going to get fucked in the dream, why is this the ugliest person around? And, kids used to throw piles of dog shit on our doorstep. You know how you put shit in a bag and put it on fire and throw it? So anyways, for years I said, what was that about? And I figured it out. I said, she fucked me. Because she knew I was in her, whatever she was, non-physical part of her, knew I was a new grammarian. I was cracking the code and completing it, and that was her life work, to teach stupid little grammar to grade 8 or something. And I've completed her task. I made it meaningful. So I figured out why she fucked me. She was paying homage to the god of grammar, me. Hermeneutics. That's the complex name for grammar, right? That's what you're saying, Roxana. Damn right, Miss Devan should fuck me, right? She was my groupie. Okay, so you really, the grammarians and the rhetoricians, They dominated for large stretches of time over the dialecticians, who were logic and mathematicians. They were minor. And it wasn't until the printing press came in, and you get Descartes and Newton and Leibniz, they started making the calculus. So dialectics, or math and logic, took over in a new way, a very abstract way, not the math of numerology or astronomy. But and so for 300 years, you had this extreme math, arithmetic and geometry and math.
You know, this has to do with what I wanted to ask Ion, because we have all these senses, and actually, for example, McLuhan expands the grammar to the objects and the visual, not only to the spoken word.
That's
like
right.
We communicate in all these nonverbal ways.
Yeah.
And but only the word manifests. But then it's like,
Are you meaning by visuality, gesture, body language?
No, the way that we can translate thought, for example, in painting, like McLuhan said, or
painting speech.
We translate the words, what we see in objects, or like objects become symbols, or like they were talking today, these video essays or installations, they are also speaking. They're telling a whole very complex discourse only with images, with the video.
Right. So they don't use all the extensions.
Yeah, we don't only communicate with words, but we have all this faculty to also communicate with symbols and
well, that's
and
what
visual.
Esther was getting at. Esther Leslie was talking about synesthesia. That's all the senses mixed up. But I don't get what your original point is, that McLuhan went visual. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think he was the first who started using grammar not only for words and language, but for environment.
Yeah. No, that's what he was. That's what he did. The new grammar for the new languages, the new media environments. That's what he did. That was the title of his essays. So, is that what Esther Leslie's trying to do? She's saying we've got to look at the synesthesia of multimedia or video and come up with a new language, a new grammar? Is that what she's trying to say?
No, she didn't say it that way, but
right. She should have. That's what they're looking for.
She only mentioned that words like evoke both spaces, like the acoustic and the visual.
Yeah. She didn't use the other senses, even though she mentioned synesthesia. Well, she's a book person, right? She teaches books, and that's a big, heavy bias in her. Even though she has to look at modern media, post-book media, she basically is trying to write it down and put it back into book form without knowing the grammar of books or the grammar as an environment compared to the grammar of the new environments. That's partly why McLuhan was rather flippant about bookish issues, serious questions that books write about philosophy, and he would move on right past those. He wouldn't get stopped and get all concerned, because he basically was just generating patterns, because he knew the society was all involved in trying to recognize patterns in the information overload. So he mimed it. He acted it out. He just endless pattern recognition. So he said, when I write books, I look around and grab anything. Not necessarily looking for facts. When he writes books, he's going to visualize a post-visual environment, and he's going to use the old medium of books, and he's really cavalier about what he uses, because he wants the book to show the pattern of the TV environment, which doesn't have any verbal meaning or verbal semantic point. There's too much going on for that.
Another thing they were mentioning in the radical philosophy is that all these processes that are happening, they're so complex. Like,
and they kept talking about the complexity, right?
Yes, that
And that's all I like can say.
They're trying to study them, but at the same time...
They don't have the tools to do it, because they don't know the tools have been established over there in McLuhan Land and Finnegan's Wake. They don't know the tools. I mean, McLuhan's obviously giving you the tools, and anybody can get it. You don't. It's not an elaborate jargon or some obscure mathematics. You just have to think about it for a while, and then you get the tetrad, and you're given a practical tool about what's going on as a citizen.
Yes, and one thing I found interesting, he said on the last conference, it was about, I think, power of the people, but they didn't know. I'm not sure what was the thing, but the thing was they didn't know if they should call it like power of the people and then an interrogation sign or power of the people with the exclamation sign.
That was a panel? That was a panel?
Yes, because then when they present these topics, at the end, they also it's also so complicated, so complex that they didn't really arrive at any conclusion. They're just presenting some paper.
Yeah, you know what? Part of the academic world is it's a new form of publishing. You've got to go to conferences to show that you're an active professor in the community, and so all these panels are used for. Tourism and for networking for other jobs. They really aren't that concerned about where the papers lead.
Right. They're just presenting this paper, but at the end there is no conclusion.
That's right. They're there for other reasons. Professional networking, to get it published, to have fun, have secret affairs, all kinds of stuff. So... it's very irritating, the academic panel world. And they weren't academics, but there were a lot of academics there, but they were, journalists, essayists, amateurs for a magazine. But a magazine is a school. It's a classroom geared to a certain audience.
But I found that very revealing. They don't know. Should we have an exclamation sign at the end of the title or a question mark?
Yeah. How do we start a revolution?
Are we asking
or are we telling? Are we modern or are we a fascist? Are we monarchists or surrealists? Yeah, no, that is hilarious that they were trying to figure out how to introduce themselves to the man on the street or to the 5-year-old on the street. Get them younger as soon as possible. That was that kid, that 15-year-old I saw at the European Graduate School, man. He was well-versed in Marxism, and the older profs were grooming him to be the next next great panelist. All roads lead to a panel.
Yeah.
Are you there, Bert? Do you have anything to say?
I have background noise, Bob, so I'm on mute for a little bit.
We don't care. We need your input. I can't talk to Roxana constantly. We gotta have other voices.
So, Bob, when McLuhan goes into a crowd like he does, he instantly starts to use his tetrad when they bring up subjects offhand. That's his main tool when he talks in the, like Roxana said, that he's like ping pong an idea. So when they present an idea to him, he just runs it through his tetrad.
Yes, he'll mention the idea presented to him in relation to some future stuff that's in hand, or he'll point out what was obsolete or what was retrieved or what it would flip into. So he takes different aspects of the four laws of McLuhan and doesn't seem to be answering the question.
But he has words for him.
Yes, he has instant words on any point. And I have that. I know exactly how he operates. He's got so much in his head, you just have to say a word and he's ready with some information, very fast. The Del Himes, the anthropologist there, you look up the long interview with McLuhan at the back of Hot and Cool, Roxana. And Ted Carpenter writes to McLuhan about how incompetent Dale Himes is. And his criticism of McLuhan and Ted Carpenter is puny. Well, I never knew the guy. I didn't know anything about him. So here he is in this recording in a panel with McLuhan, probably around the time that he wrote that review, if not earlier. And he's a real weakling intellectually. He doesn't even know what he wants to say. And he's intimidated. And I don't think he knew what how McLuhan was criticizing him until he read that book. But that's the famous Del Himes. He's right there. And he sounds like this young guy who's not sure of himself. Did you notice that guy?
Yes.
At the end, they ask him, do you have any closing thoughts? And he said, no, I don't have any.
Can you hear me?
Is that Bart?
It's Bart, yeah.
How you doing, Bart?
All right. Hey, Bart.
If it sounds like you just got up, I did.
Yeah, Bart, you've missed so many weeks, Bart. What the fuck? We haven't heard from you in 6 weeks, man. What the hell are you doing?
I actually was taking a bit of a breather.
Oh, you can't do that.
But I wanted to interject on the McLuhan point. When he would speak to anybody extemporaneously, there were a lot of times when McLuhan had an agenda, even if he wasn't, I think maybe regardless of whether or not he was good at speaking spontaneously, he seemed to want to force points through.
Exactly.
So even,
he was.
Yeah, even when people would ask him questions, he would remain on a subject.
Yeah,
almost ignoring those questions.
That's exactly it. There's this interview at the college newspaper at U of T. I always remember the St. Mike's, the journalist, student journalist interviewed him. And the first thing they say, I came out of that interview, dialogue with McLuhan, and thought, that guy didn't answer one of my questions. He had other things he wanted to say. And that was true. He wanted to talk about what he didn't want to repeat what he had said. Now it's a new year. He wants to give patterns that apply to 1971, you know, where he wants to talk about today. And he did that. That's exactly it. And this bugged people. You know, you have professors who lived at University of Toronto for years. They saw McLuhan in action many times. So they had started to notice the pattern, and it was not, to them, old-fashioned, genuine, or there was a game going on, or they'd call him a charlatan. So he rubbed people because he was a put-on artist. And he even wrote in the 40s that he was going to infiltrate decent society. He put decent in quotes.
Yeah, but it makes it look like from one angle or perspective that he doesn't have
the
ability
have
to respond.
He's winging it. He's making shit up, man. That's right. That's what it looks like.
Well, no, to me it looks like he's got his written material. He in some ways it looks like he's not capable of responding spontaneously to various subject matter.
He isn't.
I know that's
That would degenerate into small talk and arguing over facts and details. He has a poem he wants to get all stanzas said. I mean, I used to see his notes. He didn't have a paper. You know what he'd have? He'd have an envelope, and it would list about eight little shorthand words. And once you knew his stuff, you knew what they're referring to. So you have a little, you know, piece of Kleenex, a piece of this, and have eight notes. And he would get those said, and that's what he wanted to say. So he wanted to create effects, the objective artist. He had effects and topics. He wanted to talk about the streakers or about Watergate because that was topical, not about what the apparent topic was. He was speaking to the world with his ongoing composition. Well, Zappa did the same thing. Zappa said that he was a journalist, and McLuhan was like that.
Yeah, he didn't want to get lost in the frivolous sort of the details
yeah.
of conversation.
He was there.
Yes.
Yes, he was not there to propagandize for one concept or that idea or this concept. He was there to create a simulation of the day of the present environment and be a poet and theatrically mirror it back to people. That's what he was doing. And nobody knew that's what he was doing.
You're taking them out of their content or whatever distraction they had and creating that pattern and forcing them into recognizing the patterns.
He wanted to wake them up in a new way of doing it. Not do it where people aren't ready for it. They don't expect it. He said, do some. Remember? He always liked the quote, the burglar distracts the watchdog. What do you call it?
Oh, right.
Yeah. He distracts the watchdog of the mind with the juicy piece of meat. Distract the watchdog of the mind. So all these people sitting there saying, oh, we heard about you. Let's hear you, Mr. McClone. Let's say you're going to be smart now. Entertain us, as Nirvana says. You know, entertain us. And he knows that's the challenge. And he's going to surprise them by what he talks about. And they'll forget the game of, do you really know? You don't know anything. I don't know. And all of a sudden they're saying, what the fuck's he talking about? And they get lost in it and they start having insights because their mind collapses. Their watchdog of their mind stops. Just like Ion does that.
Yeah.
Actually, in the sense that they're just speaking from an agenda, that's what Ezekiel did when he came through on that Ion call.
Yeah. and I knew that. Now, there's the comedy of it. Now, this is Bart. I knew that, so I pretended to be a guy who didn't understand it. And I took advantage of making references to my New York life and the people on the subway and all this. It was a total theatrical response by me. It was so good, Ion will not let me talk to him anymore.
So you were cousins? You were cousins with McClellan?
No, we're talking about Ezekiel. We're not going to get lost in Loretta's confusion. You had your day in court. If that's Loretta, we're not going down your fucking door. Listen.
He talked about how television was more of a entertainment medium than it was a... then it was like more of a something about, it was more merchandising medium than entertainment medium.
Okay, is that Loretta talking?
Yeah.
You're one hallucinating dude. He was trying to point out that TV wasn't entertainment. It wasn't a frivolous thing that you watch
on
the weekend.
That's what I just said. I said it wasn't a merch. It was more a merchandise.
No, that's the second time. You started off saying he was trying to show that television was an entertaining medium.
No,
didn't you say that?
No, I kind of got it.
Yeah, you got it mixed up because you're over
no,
your head.
No, I didn't get it mixed up. I was trying to say it, but it was coming out wrong.
Yeah, so that's called mixed up.
I told the doctor nitric acid, and I meant nitric oxide.
Yes, this is what happens when you've been a discarnate super angel consuming media for 40 years or something, and you are a little behind the ball right here, right now. You're just finding out.
What I meant to say was he was saying television is more merchandising medium than an entertainment medium.
No, he wasn't saying that at all. The guy who made the TV show Batman, he complained that he didn't like the way his own profession was going. It was getting more commercial. And he predicted that TV would be duller and duller. So fucking wrong. That's ridiculous. Throw him to the dustbin of history. McClellan is saying that the content of television, not anything on it, was relevant. He's talking about the form, the fact that the light shot at you through your gut and into your eyes, into your body, and extended your central nervous system. It was not light on like bouncing off a book page. Now, you never even heard that ever said. You don't even know what I mean, but that's exactly what he's talking about. If you listen to it enough, he repeats that idea all the time. He's talking about the form, not the content.
Mm-hmm.
And television created the drug environment, right?
Say it again?
In some form, television created the drug environment, the internet.
Yeah, he said that television created a psychedelic environment for the whole society and all the older institutions, and that taking drugs was a puny thing, not even worth banning. You should ban TV for what it was doing to society. And those who were taking drugs, he said, actually were trying to catch up to the effects of television.
He just said that now?
You said that 50 years ago.
I know, but I mean the one you just played?
No, he said that a couple weeks ago.
Oh.
You would have heard that. Yeah, we played a lot of McLuhan. But he's the best guy. I was thinking about how great, Roxy, I was thinking about how great I'm playing this McLuhan. It's the greatest stuff to hear now. It's the only guy worth hearing about. He's a miracle. It's amazing. He may be obsolete in terms of what we're doing, but it is the best stuff to hear. On many levels.
Did you? Yes. I saw you did your youth. What's youth called?
Yes. And you ask me, where is it, Bart? Where is it? What the fuck? Go to Achieve Radio. Look at the schedule. You know Achieve Radio, right?
I do, but you put it in the schedule in advance. I didn't.
Yeah, you didn't look, Bart.
I've been used to show times. I stopped looking at Achieve, and I never knew that they put the show schedule in advance.
Yeah, see? You forgot. He's telling me. What, Bert?
I said Bart's busted right there.
Yeah, we just busted. I've been waiting to get him. He fucking sends me emails. Where is this show, Bob? And I waited till it was like over. 10 hours later, he had said, what time's it on? Yeah. And 10 hours later, I told him it was on at 9 p.m., and he had to laugh at that because, you know, I was rather late telling him.
He also said the railroad station.
Right. Yeah, he did say those two words, but it actually had some more words. You want to say the rest of the sentence?
Well, he was saying how the railroad station looks more aesthetic, but it's really, it's trying to, you know, it's trying to be something it's not.
Oh, man. This is, we're getting great testimony of a bamboozled citizen here. Can't even, it's so ridiculous.
But Lucas said recalling is the most creative act.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is memory. She's making up shit. She's memory. the railroad station, as if it's alive, was trying to say it wasn't this. No, no, no.
Wasn't
no.
He said, talk about the railroad station in
memories
England.
Are happening.
In England, too, and he was saying about the railroad. No.
Not the railroad station, the railroad.
Yeah, the railroad.
No, okay, so what did he say the railroad did?
He was saying something that it wasn't working well, like something about...
he was saying something about something. I had no idea what it was, but he did say something.
He was posing. The railroad stations are pretending something to be something they're not.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean.
The railroad was winging it. It wasn't really a railroad.
Well, what was he saying then?
Now, listen.
He was
now,
talking
we're not
about that.
Hey, Loretto. Just a minute. Yeah. I want to say this. We're not making fun of you. We're laughing at you with you, Nat. But we love that you come in with your ignorance. And say this stuff. It makes great entertainment. So, but you don't. You're not going to lose your job. You don't have to get paranoid. You don't have to be fucking insulted.
I'm still part of the CEO.
Yeah, you're still fucking CEO. Okay. So the what did Roxy say? You were explaining Roxy.
That he was talking about Batman.
Yes, but he also talked about the record, the railroad. Discuss what he said about the railway.
Me?
No, Roxy. Uh-huh. Have her explain to you what the railway was doing. What was McLuhan saying about it?
Well, he was talking about the effects of
the railroad.
Inventions of new technologies that we may
like
not...
Like the railroad.
Yeah,
He was saying that the railroad, he said it, brought in unforeseen changes to the society. And affected family, church, religion, and your people's dreams. What he actually says other places is the railroad created Freud. Because the railway allowed people to leave where they grew up, where they had uncles and aunts and the clan, and they had to go to cities and be isolated as a little nuclear family. The nuclear family that the American televangelists worship is a product of the railway. There was no family like that before the railway. And then the tensions of just being with mom, dad, and the kid and a sister or something was so great that everybody got neurotic and they needed psychoanalysis to understand the dynamics of the nuclear family. That was an effect of the railway. Tell that to Freud. Mr. Freud, you're just a mere reflex to the railway environment. He wouldn't know what to say to that.
So
it was not the Oedipal complex. It was not the...
Yeah, it was not an inky... Yeah, as I said, it wasn't the inky, dark unconscious. It wasn't the sex drive. It was the fucking railway that made America, the Europeans the way he perceived them. Neurotics looking for an audience. They just wanted someone to talk to. They didn't have anybody. If you're living with a husband and a kid or two, and that's all you have, that is such a strain on people compared to the community of agricultural lives.
But how does you go to Maui? Doesn't that make you part of that, like being isolated?
Well, it's a smart thing to do. Look, these families get so neurotic, you want to get away from them. Yes, we killed our family. We got away from as much as possible.
Oh.
We didn't even have kids. We didn't even have kids.
Who can blame you?
That's right. Nobody can.
The railroad thing, though, is a good way to give her the overview of the technological environments and how they create...
Yes,
with,
you look at...
Yeah.
Okay, McLuhan said that the generals always fight the last war. They don't fight the present war. They're actually trying to retrieve the establishment they represent as it gets upset by the new unforeseen effects of a new technology. So why was there an American Civil War? And there's a book, McLuhan's talking about the historians couldn't agree on what caused the Civil War. Now, the average person has all these myths and things. But the actual historian studies said, we can't figure out what caused it. And McLuhan said they couldn't figure it out because they don't look at the telegraph. The telegraph caused the American Civil War. Then there's details I won't bother. It'll take me weeks to explain, so we'll move on. So then... So what did World War I do? The railway, the automobile, the airplane, the technologies that were coming in at 1914, they caused the war. But the generals had studied the effects of the railway on 19th century wars, especially the American Civil War. So they saw that they were fighting a railway war and went and shipped all the people to the front on the railways, and then the guys got bogged down and lived in the mud for 4 years for no reason, got all killed up. They didn't recognize the new media. They fought the previous war.
So the trains caused the war?
Yeah. Yeah. The trains and telegraph were new technologies, and that broke apart the pastoral United States and the Civil War. And then... Okay, so the generals got 1865 to, they got 50 years to sort of say, what's coming up, what's going on? So they studied this new weird war, the American Civil War, and figured out, how to use the train in some way, whatever crazy shit they fake. Cause remember, most of them were just fucking prostitutes in that period. It was the Belle Epoque, a wonderful period of peace in Europe, so nobody was really doing any of their jobs. All of a sudden, the car and the airplane makes a new war has to happen. And the telegraph and the telephone, so World War I breaks out, and generals say, well, I guess this is going to be a railway war. That's the last one we noticed, technology. So they studied the railway. They took out what they'd studied or thought they knew from railways, shipped everybody to the mud banks of France, Somme and all those places, and then they just sat them there, and they just took pot shots at each other. And the war was actually being fought on another level. I mean, the real war was the information war. And World War I was a disaster because the generals didn't know what they were fighting for. So then World War II, and radio comes along. So they redo World War I and get even worse. And what's the secret technology? IBM is using computer technology in the concentration camps. There's a hidden environment happening right there. And the radar was discovered during World War II. So all these present technologies were the byproducts of a war that was fighting the previous war. The generals always fight the previous war. That happened in Vietnam. It's happening right now with Afghanistan.
It's like, do you differentiate literate wars and pre-literate wars?
Yeah, and post-literate wars.
Post-literate.
Yeah, no, World War I, this is how McLuhan described it, World War I was a war over centralization. You know, with railroads, you centralize and create big cities. So that happened in the 19th century. So World War I tried to fight the centralizing wars around the railway effect and not noticing the decentralized effect of the airplane, the telephone, and movies and that. So then comes along World War II. That's not a war of centralization, that's a war of decentralization. Because the radio and the telephone and public address system fragments the society. All those different parts of the Nazi Party, they Goebbels and these guys, they ran their own little sub-armies. And Albert Speer writes about that in the first issue of Explorations, which came out in McLuhan's Journal in 1953. So railway, so they probably fought an airplane war, or the older technologies from World War One was the content of World War Two, but the real effect was caused by the decentralization of radio. So World War One was a war of centralization. World War Two was a war of decentralization. So what was, and that allowed the mafias to take over too. So what happened in World War Three? How would he define that? Can you figure it out? Just following the sequence?
Well, centralization, then decentralization.
What's next? You won't know.
Total surveillance.
What?
Total surveillance.
No. He said World War III was the TV war, called the Cold War, because TV is a cold medium, of information, warfare of information patterns, where the civilian and the military, there's no division between them. So he said that World War III was a TV war of information.
TV.
Listen to this. TV war of information with no division between civilian and military front.